It's the Kim Munson Show, analyzing the most important stories.
Socialization of transportation, education, energy, housing, and water. What it means is that government controls it through rules and regulations.
The latest in politics and world affairs.
Under this guise of bipartisanship and nonpartisanship, it's actually tapped down the truth.
Today's current opinions and ideas.
On an equal field in the battle of ideas, mistruths or misconceptions, and it is getting us into a world of hurt.
Is it freedom or is it force? Let's have a conversation.
Indeed. Let's have a conversation and welcome to the show. I am Kim Munson. Be sure and check out our website. That is Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. Sign up for our weekly newsletter. That's where we roll out. You get the first look at all the guests that we'll have for the next week, as well as our op-eds, our guest op-eds, and our Sounding Off with Kim Munson podcast. This week, we'll be rolling out a podcast that we did with Dr. Jill Vecchio, her 10-point plan to fix healthcare in America. And so you won't want to miss that. That will be just fascinating. We'd appreciate it if you go over to Facebook and give us a like as well. It is, it's Wednesday, isn't it, Steve?
Yeah, that's what my little window says. You know, when they developed this software package we use for broadcasting, it's all-inclusive, comprehensive, and it includes a little window that tells you the actual day of the week.
And which is good, because
you Lord knows we need it.
We do need it, for sure. And that voice is producer Steve. Thank you for this great team that I get to work with. And that is producer Steve, Zach, Patty, Keith, and Charlie. And all of these folks over at Crawford Broadcasting, and you listeners, each of you, you're treasured, you're valued, you have a purpose. Strive for excellence today. Take care of your heart, your soul, your mind, and your body, and engage in this battle of ideas that is raging in America right now. I stopped into a sandwich shop yesterday, Steve, and the guy in front of me, I guess we looked at each other with the mask that he had is hanging on his ear. And I said, oh, is that effective? And he said, well, I just kind of have it hanging here until somebody asked me to put it on. He says, but I sure know who I'm voting for this election. So we had a very nice conversation.
Question is, who did he vote for the last time?
I didn't ask that question, but...
I mean, just to see that, you know, does this alone influence people to such levels as saying, you know, not again, pal.
So anyway, we're looking forward. I didn't even think to ask him who he voted last time.
Well, no, you don't want to get into that habit.
Yeah. But, you know, moving forward, we were talking about issues, and certainly I think some people were listening to us what we were saying as well. So big show planned for you, though. Matt Durkin will be here the second segment talking about safety of our communities. My gosh, producer Steve, that is front and center these days. I saw a video of Minneapolis. It looks like a war zone. It's just unbelievable what's happening to these Democrat-run cities.
I saw a thing, I think it was on Fox, the Fox website, but said Minneapolis or Minnesota, I guess, is asking for $55 million for the feds to fix Minneapolis. And one of the responses on there was, why don't you ask BLM for that money?
Exactly.
We certainly are getting more and more indicators that BLM has very deep pockets.
They do. And so that is a very good idea. Why should everybody else pay for the decisions of these Democrat mayors and governors? And if the people of Minneapolis don't like what's happening to their city, then they need to vote them out. So elections do matter.
I saw another interesting piece. The governor of Minnesota and the mayor of Minneapolis, it hasn't broken all out war yet, but the finger pointing between the two of them is it's almost humorous.
So they're not taking responsibility for their actions, huh?
Well, it's I told you, and why didn't you I said to you, and you know, it's, oh jeez,
this is going to get interesting. Get your popcorn for sure. In the third and fourth segment, Randall O'Toole, he is a senior fellow with the Cato Institute, also an expert in land use and transportation. We'll talk about a couple of different things. One is the fact that President Trump is getting rid of AFFH, Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing, because in essence what that would do is it would change the fabric of our communities. And then also he talks about an environmentalist that he says has come clean on the climate scare. So you won't want to miss that. We look at these issues, my friends, as freedom versus force, force versus freedom. They are now using fear to use force to take away our freedom. And it's never compassionate to take other people's rights, their property, their freedom, or their livelihood via force, whether it's with a weapon, policy, your fave, producer Steve, unpredictable and excessive taxation, or fear. If something is a good idea, you should not have to use force to implement it. And so as we look at these questions that are before us, these issues before us, we ask what, why, when, how, where, and who. Our quote for today is Dwight D. Eisenhower. And he was an American Army general who served as the 34th president of the United States. During World War II, he became the five-star general in the Army and served as supreme commander of the Allied Expeditionary Force in Europe. He was responsible for planning and supervising the invasion of North Africa in Operation Torch in 1942 and 43, and the successful invasion. I hate to call it invasion. Christy Whaley always says, don't call it an invasion. It's the liberation. And they landed on the beaches in Normandy in 1944-45 from the Western Front. He was born in 1890. He died in 1969 at the age of 78. And I love this. He said, there is nothing wrong with America that faith, love of freedom, intelligence, and energy of her citizens cannot cure, Steve. I love that one.
Wow. If we could just somehow relaunch that.
That's what we're doing.
Well, yes. But, you know, how much of the population is getting that and thinking in those terms? You know, what you just said about it was an invasion, it was a liberation. If there's any doubt, let's ask the people of France what they called it.
You know, when I was over there in Normandy with these World War II veterans back in 2016, the people of Normandy still revere these guys. And you know what they do? They actually teach the history of what happened on D-Day in the schools. Kids actually have to learn about that, which that will bring us over to, let's see, the first headline that you and I were talking about. You just love this one. This is from NBC and Chicago.com. Chicago area leaders are calling for Illinois to abolish history classes. It says leaders in education, politics, and other areas gathered in suburban Evanston Sunday to ask that the Illinois State Board of Education change the history curriculum at schools statewide and temporarily halt instruction until an alternative is decided upon. At a news conference, State Representative LaShawn Ford said current history teachings lead to a racist society and overlook the contributions of women and minorities. How about if we look at the contributions of individuals? Steve, we realize that Marxism puts people in groups. It doesn't look at people as individuals. And so it gets rid of individualism and it gets rid of private property rights. And all this stuff has been percolating underneath the surface for quite some time. I'm grateful that we are getting clarity to these issues. And we look at the contributions of individuals and what they did for freedom. And as Calvin Coolidge said, if all men are created equal, then that is final. If all men are created with inalienable rights of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, then that is final. Steve, your thought?
Well, when this first popped up, I guess it was yesterday, but it's the first time I saw it. And the quote from this guy, this LaShawn Ford, is that we need to stop teaching history until a suitable alternative is developed. Well, what in the world is a suitable alternative? And then he goes on, he kind of shoots himself in the foot. And he says, the state representative is sponsoring a bill that would require elementary schools to teach students about the civil rights movement. Well, on one hand, he's saying we need to stop teaching history, but what is the civil rights movement in terms of teaching about it?
It's history.
A piece of history.
Yeah. It is astounding.
What a dope.
And Chicago, you know, they're doing really great. You look at these, these shootings every weekend, the murders every weekend. How about these representatives try to figure out how they can lift these kids out of these bad school systems, out of these very violent neighborhoods? That's what they should be focused on. So a couple of other things I wanted to mention.
Smoke and mirrors.
Smoke and mirrors.
Yes.
Is the North Carolina, this was from last week, Patty pulled this from the Free Beacon. A North Carolina teachers union demands universal health care and welfare for illegal immigrants to reopen schools. Now, what does that have to do with teaching children? And, you know, again, this is bringing clarity to these issues. There's so many great public school teachers. However, we knew that the teachers union did not have the kids' best interest in mind, nor do they have the teachers' best interest in mind. It is a political machine that is moving forward, trying to move us to more and more socialism and Marxism. And so with that, I gave a speech this last weekend at the Thomas Aquinas Society. And we talked about education. And one of the things that I pulled out, I don't know if you've ever seen this, and Snopes is trying to debunk this, but I would recommend that you do a web search for this. And this is the examination graduation questions to graduate from eighth grade in 1895 in Saline County, Kansas. Now, my grandmother had an eighth grade education, and, you know, it used to imply that you didn't have a lot of learning, if you will. Well, take a look at this. She was very wise. She was very well read. And so this test took 5 hours and 45 minutes. And it had a variety of different subjects: grammar, geography, arithmetic, history, health, and orthography. Do you know what orthography means, Steve?
I do not. But you read me some of these questions last week, and it was incredibly intimidating. So press on here.
Okay. Orthography is basically the study of languages. But under grammar, this was the first question. Give 9 rules for the use of capital letters. A question under arithmetic. A wagon box is 2 feet deep, 10 feet long, and 3 feet wide. How many bushels of wheat will it hold? Geography. Of what use are rivers? Of what use is the ocean? Describe the mountains of North America. Orthography. What is meant by the following: alphabet, phonetic, orthography, entomology, and syllabication? My friends, this is what used to be taught in one-room schoolrooms by one teacher with multiple grades in one school. And so I would highly recommend that you take a look at that. Something interesting that I think is happening with this COVID-19 Wuhan virus reaction disruption is with the kids at home and the online learning, parents are seeing what is being taught in school. And Charlie mentioned something interesting to me yesterday. He said that some parents are saying, hey, my kids were done within an hour and a half of their schoolwork. So it begs the question, what are they doing for the balance of the day at the school? And so I thought that those were very important questions. So, my friends, the veil is coming off. And, you know, I think that we're seeing a real disruption in education, which I think is a positive, because I think a lot of parents didn't know what was going on. The teachers union wasn't letting people know what was being taught. We're seeing that they're trying to get rid of history. And so, my friends, we need to step up and make sure that we address what is happening in education right now. We're going to go to break. Before we do that, though, you know, one of my great partners is Hooters Restaurants, and they're actually doing something I think really cool, and that is until, I think it is, August 16th, they are doing a fundraiser for Sacred Heart House of Denver, which is a local charity, and it helps prevent single women and single moms and their children from homelessness. And so you can drop by any of the Colorado locations. There's 5 locations, and donate, and you'll get your name on the wall. And you can round up your change on any tab, $15 or more, and you'll even get a free fried pickle appetizer or $5 off your bill if you want that. And it's valid for that day only, and it's for dine-in if you're there eating. So be sure and check out order.hooters.com. They've got great specials. We're going to go to break. We'll be right back with Matt Durkin.
Karen Levine has over 30 years in the real estate industry. The reaction to the COVID-19 Wuhan virus is presenting unprecedented and unpredictable opportunities and challenges in buying or selling your home. That is why you need to work with award-winning realtor Karen Levine. Karen Levine comes highly recommended by Kim Munson. Call award-winning realtor Karen Levine today at 303-877-7516. Karen's expertise will help guide you through this crazy real estate market. Call Karen Levine at 303-877-7516 today.
All of Kim's sponsors are an inclusive partnership with Kim and are not affiliated with or in partnership with KLZ or Crawford Broadcasting. If you would like to support the work of the Kim Munson Show and grow your business, contact Kim at her website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com.
I see trees of green.
Ah, one of my favorite songs. Welcome back to The Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out our website, Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. Be sure and sign up for our weekly newsletter because you get the first look at all the cool stuff that we're doing. And go over to Facebook and give us a like. On the line with me is Matt Durkin. He is a candidate for district attorney for Jefferson and Gilpin counties. And my friends, as we see what's happening in these Democrat-run cities with these George Soros bought and paid for district attorneys, we see what is happening to community safety. And having a safe community, a peaceful community, is inherently important for people to pursue their happiness. So Matt Durkin, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kim. It's great to be back.
Okay, Matt Durkin. Joshua Scharf in Complete Colorado wrote on August 1st that Denver crime is rising dramatically. And it continues. Some trends erases gains in others. He said the first half of 2020 has seen a sharp spike in both violent and property crime in Denver. In some cases, the increase continues or accelerates a trend that has been in place for years, while in other cases, it reverses gains. And while the increases have been citywide, they've not been evenly distributed across the city council districts. This is really unfair that we do not have safe communities. And I know that you're watching this closely, Matt Durkin. What's your latest update on all this?
Well, we've seen a spike in crime, obviously in Denver. That's gotten a lot of press. But most recently, we are now seeing crime rates in other cities across the Denver metro area. Aurora is also seeing a huge increase in crime. In Denver, they've seen a 47% increase in murders this year. Aurora has seen a 53% increase in murders this year, which is just devastating to those communities. We've seen...
And you know what, Matt Durkin? Those lives matter. Those lives matter.
Yes. Well, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's just such a tragedy to those victims. Some of them are young people under the age of 18. Obviously devastating to those families and to those communities. But in addition to those very disturbing trends, in Aurora, we see that aggravated assault is up 27%. Robbery is up 14%. Burglary is up 23%. We have talked about car thefts is up 21%, and theft is up 7%. So all of that is quite a recipe for a really unsafe community. And obviously, at that same time, to say things like defund the police and attack prosecution, those two things are just completely inconsistent with one another.
Well, it is astounding what we're seeing in these cities, these Democrat-run cities with these George Soros bought and paid for district attorneys. There was another piece. If people think it can't come to your community, think again. This was a Fox News report. It says the New York City crime spree knocks on the doorsteps of America's ultra-rich. And this is on the Upper East Side. And it says over roughly the past month, the precinct that covers the Upper East Side, which is real shishi in New York, is seen robberies skyrocket 286% compared with the same period last year, with 27 reported incidents, and five of them were gunpoint robberies. So if we don't work to make sure that all of our communities are safe, this spills over to other communities as well. So people need to be paying attention to this, Matt Durkin.
Absolutely. And historically, here in Jefferson County, we have seen as many as 50 to 70% of our felonies are from those people who come into Jefferson County from places like Denver and Aurora. So we obviously are affected by these crime rates as well. And although we don't have the hard data anecdotally, it feels as though about 20 to 30% of our current felonies are those who have been released because of the COVID situation. They were released early or had a reduced bond back in March or April. So we are seeing quite an impact just this year from a lot of different external forces, from COVID to bad policy.
You know, I don't think it really matters what political affiliation somebody has. I really think that the Blue Dog Democrats, unaffiliateds, libertarians, and conservatives, all of them want safe communities. Now, I didn't say Democrats. This Democrat Party that we see now is not the Democrat Party of JFK. They are, and we really have a time for choosing, Matt, between those people that are pushing forward the agenda that has taken over the Democrat Party. And we see what is happening with that. We see crime, we see destruction, we see defacement of our capital. Or do we want safe communities, peaceful communities? I mean, it's coming into a very clear focus for me, Matt Durkin.
Kim, you're absolutely right. And this is something that I've been speaking to for a year and a half. And this is something that I've dedicated nearly my whole career, nearly 25 years to, which is whether or not you're Republican, Democrat, or anything else. As a community, it's important we put public safety, community safety, the safety of our neighborhoods and businesses over politics. This is something that we all not only want, but we all enjoy. It's what we do in this community, whether or not you're, whatever your political affiliation is. So we have a distinct choice this fall. We have a distinct choice to make on November 3rd, and that is whether or not you want public safety and public order, or you want to see chaos continue.
And so let's just explain to our listeners how this works. We've got about 3 minutes. Matt Durkin. And so if somebody commits a crime, the police arrest them. So just quickly walk us through that process. What happens? And why is the district attorney so important?
Well, it's important. I mean, you see downtown lay in ruins, and there's not one criminal prosecution for millions of dollars of damage to the state capitol and the surrounding community around the state capitol. And that's what makes this so important. And so what happens when somebody is arrested is obviously the police contact that person, whether or not there's been a call or whether or not they've seen that crime be committed. They'll do an investigation. They have to have probable cause to make that arrest and develop evidence for that probable cause. Assuming that that person is arrested based upon probable cause, they're taken in front of a judge. And then it's at that point that the DA's office takes over, and they take that case and prosecute that case. And it is a DA's job. It's their mission. It's our mission that we take very seriously, that we pursue justice, not just convictions, but that we pursue justice in each and every case. And justice could be perhaps not offering a plea bargain if it's a homicide, not offering a plea bargain and offering that the defendant get the fairest trial possible, and we may ask for a maximum sentence, all the way down to perhaps somebody is in a bad time in their life and they're making bad choices due to drugs or mental health issues. Perhaps we can use the criminal justice system to offer probation, and through that probation or diversion, they can get on the mend so that they don't come back. So one way or the other, this the state and our communities, we need to attack a 50% recidivism rate here in Colorado, which is one of the worst in the country. And that means that within 3 years of completing their sentence, that they're back. And so whether or not that is through violent crime, that we put them in prison for longer periods of time, or whether or not we help them with their issues that they're facing so that they don't come back and re-victimize our community, we need to make sure that we attack that recidivism rate.
And that's why these DA races are so important. So, Matt Durkin, how can people help you?
Well, Kim, thank you so much for having me on. We are in probably one of the most important races and one of the most important election years in our lifetime. It is, as you have said, it is in our communities now. We need to fight together to protect our communities, to make sure that we have safe neighborhoods, safe businesses. So please go to durkinforda.com, durkinforda.com, to contribute and volunteer. We are walking the streets, talking to our neighbors. We have phone banks. We are working around the clock to make sure we put our message of putting public safety over politics to get justice in each and every case to our friends, our family, and our neighbors all over Jefferson and Gilpin County.
Well, Matt Durkin, thank you so much. We'll talk to you again in a few weeks.
Thanks, Kim. Take care.
Have a good day. And Jason McBride, Presidential Wealth Management, a happy Wednesday.
Well, happy Wednesday to you too, Kim.
So what is going on in the market? I haven't been paying attention for the last few days.
Well, it's still doing pretty good. The NASDAQ has actually blasted to a new high, Kim, after, you know, kind of going sideways for about 3 weeks. Yesterday, it jumped up very strongly, up 157 points to hit a new high. Actually, that was the day before. Yesterday it was up 38, but the NASDAQ's almost at 11,000.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. The S&P has also not gotten quite back to the old highs, but it's very close. It did break above some resistance recently and looks like it's on its way, short of some kind of catastrophic news coming out. And you know, it's funny, some of the earnings reports coming out are actually good, where we're still seeing growth with companies, but some of them are better than expected, but still horrible, and the stocks are moving up. For example, Disney, this, Kim, was a better than expected earnings report. The revenues for the quarter in June were down 42% from last year. The earnings were 8 cents a share versus $1.34, a 94% decrease for Disney, and that was considered better than expected, and the stock's up about $6 in the pre-market. So, you know, when you get in a situation like we're in now, sometimes all bets are off, and the old stuff and normal stuff doesn't work.
Well, and since old stuff and normal stuff doesn't work, the people you should be talking with about your portfolio is Jason McBride and your colleagues at Presidential Wealth Management. So, Jason, people can reach you at 303-694-1600, 303-694-1600. You have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
All right, Kim, you too.
Okay, and we're going to go to break. When we come back, Randall O'Toole regarding a couple of important issues.
Predovich & Company understands that the COVID-19 Wuhan virus disruption has individuals and businesses scratching their heads with a variety of bookkeeping, tax planning, and accounting questions. Predovich & Company knows that you need trusted professionals to help you navigate these choppy waters. Kim Munson highly recommends Predovich & Company. Because of their advanced technological capabilities, Predovich & Company can help clients anywhere in the United States. Call Predovich & Company at 303-791-3000 to organize your personal and business finances. Call 303-791-3000 today.
Now more than ever, it is important to have independent voices bringing truth and clarity to the issues facing us, our families, our communities, our state, our nation, and our world. The Kim Munson Show is one of those important voices. Kim is a truly independent entrepreneur. She purchases her broadcast time, which gives her total freedom in production of the show and scheduling of guests. If you'd like to support The Kim Munson Show, go to her website, Kim Munson, MONSON.com, and click on the contribute button under Kim's picture. Kim greatly appreciates your help and support.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out my website. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. Be sure and sign up for our weekly newsletter. It comes out on Sundays. It highlights all the upcoming guests, as well as our Sounding Off with Kim Munson podcast guests and our op-eds. I am thrilled to have on the line with me Randall O'Toole. He is a transportation and land use expert and a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. And he's had two recent publications that are very important. And the first one, you can find both of these at Complete Colorado. Randall said, the title on this, I got to get to it, Randall, is An Environmentalist Comes Clean on the Climate Scare. Randall O'Toole, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
This is absolutely fascinating. And, you know, Randall, tell people a little bit about you, what your journey has been to get to this point where you are an expert in land use and transportation.
Well, I started out working for the environmental movement. I worked for them for about 20 years in the late 70s, 80s, and early 90s. And during in the 1980s, the environmental movement was very tolerant of different viewpoints. We had Republicans working with Democrats. We had free market environmentalists working with Marxists. I remember there was a nuclear engineer at a nuclear power plant in Portland who was working for an environmental group to try to stop logging, and there was a logger working for the same environmental group trying to shut down the nuclear power plant. And they knew about each other, and they were friends, and they were perfectly fine with it. And so it was very tolerant, and the goal was to protect the environment. And, the means was less important than the end. The goal was to protect the environment. And then something happened. In about 1990, the Soviet Union fell, and suddenly polls showed that Americans thought that government messed everything up. And the polls also showed, however, that the environment was the one area where Americans thought that government action was still necessary. And suddenly we had an influx of people come into the movement, and they said, we want to help you protect the environment. And I said, that's great. Where were you before now? And they said, we were working for the labor movement. And they came in, and instead of helping to protect the environment, they started demonizing other environmentalists because the other environmentalists didn't approve of their big government programs. They came out with these extreme big government programs that required control from a central authority of everything in the country. And anybody who disagreed with that was demonized and drummed out of the movement. And they were assisted by a number of foundations led by the Pew Charitable Trusts. And these foundations started giving large amounts of money to the environmental movement, which had never received much money from foundations before. But it was all conditional upon all the environmentalists agreeing on a particular strategy. Well, these former labor movement environmentalists who came in made sure that their strategy was the one that was picked, which was make government bigger. The goal was not to protect the environment. The goal was to make government bigger. And so that's what they've done ever since. I dropped out of the movement in the mid-1990s, but climate change became their issue because free market environmentalists had shown that you could protect the environment using markets in a lot of cases, but climate was one thing that markets didn't work real well for. So it was like it was made for these big government environmentalists, that they could demand that anybody who didn't agree with climate problems would be drummed out of the movement. You had to accept their view of what science was, or you'd be demonized. And the only solution that they would allow was their central planning solutions, which coincidentally were not a lot different from the central planning solutions they had before climate change became an issue. They just claimed that their solutions would help solve climate change, even though there isn't much evidence that they will. Things like light rail or high-density housing and so on and so forth. So my experience has been that the environmental movement used to be tolerant of a wide range of viewpoints, and it isn't anymore. And recently, that idea has been confirmed by this other environmentalist named Michael Schellenberger.
Well, and he has written a new book, and I think, it's called Apocalypse Now, I believe.
And,
Apocalypse Never, excuse me.
Never, yeah.
Apocalypse Never, Why Environmental Alarmism Hurts Us All. And so this piece that you've done about him, I think is a very important piece. And he says, climate change is happening. It's just not the end of the world. It's not even our most serious environmental problem. And you said that he makes these statements in this article apologizing for the climate scare. So talk a little bit about that, Randall O'Toole.
Well, he came into the movement just as I was leaving it, And he believed that climate change was a serious crisis, and he believed that, it was an extinction-level event. You know, the human beings are going to go extinct because of climate change if we didn't do something to fix it. And the more he looked at it, the more he realized that wasn't true. But he also realized that if he started saying it wasn't true, he would lose funding, he would lose his friends, he would lose all of his, he would be demonized by his associates in the environmental movement. But after a while, he just decided he couldn't continue lying any longer and claiming that climate change was a huge crisis when it wasn't. And so he wrote this book, and he came out and said, this isn't really the problem that the environmentalists are saying it is. And, of course, they've demonized him. They've gotten publications like Forbes magazine to take down his articles that they originally published because they inundated Forbes with their tweets and their emails and things like that. And he's gone through the same thing that other environmentalists are going through in the 1990s when I was leaving the movement.
Well, and this is what is so terrifying of what is happening in America now, is that the truth is being tapped down, or just a different point of view is being tapped down. And we have to question why. Why are they doing that, Randall O'Toole?
Well, it's kind of standard tactics among socialists or big government types that anybody who disagrees with them is tossed. You know, you have to agree with everything. There's all these litmus tests. If you don't agree with all of them, then you are, put into disrepute. And this has been a standard tactic for them for the last century. You know, Stalin would kill people who disagreed with him. Mao would kill people who disagreed with him, and so on and so forth. And now, these people don't have the power that Stalin or Mao does, but I started to think what would happen if they did have that kind of power, because they are absolutely as certain about what they think is right and certain about the need to give them the power to do what they think is right as Stalin and Mao were.
Well, and playing into this environmental narrative has been computer models. And we've seen recently that computer models are just that. They're just a model. And over time, you find out whether or not they're really going to work out. And so you mentioned about your experience with the Forest Service on computer models. So tell our listeners about that, Randall O'Toole.
Well, in the 1980s, the Forest Service had a computer program called FORPLAN for forest planning that helped them decide how to manage the national forests. And for most people, it was a black box. They would come out and say, okay, if FORPLAN says we have to do this, this, and this, and it was really hard for anybody to argue with. I went around the country and visited national forests and looked at all the FORPLAN computer runs and looked at all the data that went into those runs and basically discovered that, first of all, a million-acre national forest was far too complicated to model in a computer. And second of all, in order to deal with the complexities, they had to simplify. And third, as they simplified, they injected their own biases into the model. They overestimated how fast trees could grow. They overestimated timber prices. They underestimated costs. They underestimated conflicts between timber and other resources. And then they would come out with the FORPLAN results, and they would say, oh, FORPLAN says we have to cut so much timber, we have to clear cut everywhere. And, well, it was their own biases that said that, not the computer. I got into it. I analyzed it. I wrote reports, and basically the Forest Service ended up having to back down time after time after time because I was able to reveal what they were actually telling. You know, they were lying to the computer, basically, to get it to do what they wanted to do. And eventually the Forest Service reduced its timber sales by 75% because of the things that I was finding. So I was having great success, but the main reason I was having this success is because they relied on this computer program, which could not accurately model a million-acre national forest. So now we're confronted with climate change, and we're told it's real. And how do we know it's real? We have a computer program. And the computer program is based on a model of not a million acres, but the entire planet, which is thousands and thousands of times bigger than a million acres. And not just the surface of the planet, but the whole atmosphere, which is 100 miles thick. So these models are nowhere near sophisticated enough to account for everything in the Earth's climate, but they pretend they are. And they tweak the models and come up with results that are outlandish, and yet they claim that they're genuine. And so I'm as suspicious of the computer models for climate change as I was for the computer models for forest planting.
Well, I'm suspicious as well, because I've learned, and even like surveys, when I was on city council, the city would put out a survey and you could ask questions to get an answer that you might want. And then that's touted in the newspaper as people are so happy with, you know, things going on. And so it's I started the promo with garbage in, garbage out on this, because you're going to get whatever really, I mean, they can manipulate those results the way they want to. So, Randall O'Toole, let's go ahead.
I just want to say the motto of the Forest Service planners was garbage in, gospel out.
Now that's a nugget. That is a nugget of wisdom. So let's go to break. I'm talking with Randall O'Toole, and he is a senior fellow with the Cato Institute, as well as a land use and transportation expert. And we're going to be talking about something that just happened recently with the Trump administration that really, I think, protects single family housing here in America. Before we do that, though, I want to acknowledge my new partner, and that is Castlegate Knives. Knives have been around since the Stone Age, and for good reason. They're functional, and they're durable, they're versatile, and they're an essential part of the all-American toolkit. So whether you're a hunter, an angler, or outdoorsman, you no doubt have a favorite knife or two that you just can't do without. Where do you go when you want to add a unique knife to your kit? Castlegate's Knives. They're located in Sedalia, Colorado. I have a wedding that I'm going to go to soon, and I'm going to stop by and get one of their beautiful steak knife sets for the bride and groom. So be sure and check out castlegate.com. That's castlegate.com. We'll be right back.
Recently, rates in the mortgage market have hit near record lows. Lorne Levy with Polygon Financial notes that the COVID-19 Wuhan virus disruption has created potential opportunities to refinance your mortgage that could save you thousands of dollars. And for those senior listeners who may be looking for another source of income, exploring a reverse mortgage with Lorne Levy may be a solution. With over 17 years in the mortgage industry, Lorne Levy has the experience to answer your questions. Call Lorne Levy at 303-880-8881. That's 303-880-8881 for a mortgage checkup today.
You'd like to get in touch with one of Kim Munson's sponsors, but you can't recall their phone number. Find a full list of advertising partners on Kim's website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim, M-O-N-S-O-N.com.
They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson. Be sure and check out our website. That's Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com. And sign up for our weekly newsletter. You will get the first look at all of our upcoming guests, our op-eds, and Sounding Off with Kim Munson podcasts. Be sure and go over to Facebook and give us a like as well. We greatly appreciate that. On the line with me is Randall O'Toole. He is an expert in land use and transportation issues, as well as a senior fellow with the Cato Institute. And I was listening to President Trump's speech a week or so ago, and perked my ears up when he said something about AFFH, Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing, because this was something when I was on city council back 2012 to 2016, we had a presentation made regarding these community development block grants, which was it was a way that the Office of Housing and Urban and Development was kind of controlling. It looked to me like it would control zoning and new construction within our communities, as well as trying to have certain benchmarks. So I saw real danger with the federal government coming in and trying to change the fabric of our communities. And so when President Trump said he was changing that, it really perked my ears up. So then Randall O'Toole has recently written a piece that was in Complete Colorado, and he said Trump was right to kill the federal scheme against single-family housing. So, Randall, did I set that up generally correctly?
Yes. This is an interesting debate because there's two ways that governments regulate land use. In the cities, they'll use zoning, and they'll zone some land for single family and some for multifamily and some for commercial and some for industrial. And then in the rural areas, they'll do things like put up urban growth boundaries and say you can't build outside of this boundary. Or Boulder has its green belt where they bought either the land or conservation easements on almost 10 times as much land as is in the city of Boulder itself. And there are other things they can do to prevent development in rural areas. And almost every city in America has zoning. Houston is really the only major exception. So almost every city in America has single-family zoning, and you don't see housing be really expensive just because cities have single-family zoning. I mean, Dallas and Atlanta are the two fastest-growing urban areas in America. They're very affordable. More than 100,000 people a year move into those urban areas, and they have single-family zoning. So single-family zoning isn't what's made housing expensive in some places like Boulder and San Francisco and Seattle. Instead, what it is the green belts or the urban growth boundaries that have been put around these cities that made it impossible to build new homes in the rural areas. So what the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing rule said was, if you have an urban growth boundary around your city and made it really expensive to build housing in, then you need to get rid of single-family zoning and allow people to build multi-story apartment buildings in single-family neighborhoods. And to me, that's a disconnect. You know, building multi-family apartments isn't going to make housing more affordable, because it turns out multi-family apartments, if they're three or four stories or more, cost a lot more to build than single-family homes. They cost 3 to 7 times as much per square foot to build these 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 story apartment buildings. And so you're not going to make housing more affordable if you build a bunch of more expensive housing. What you're going to do is you're going to increase congestion, you're going to stress the infrastructure and create other problems in the neighborhoods that you build these buildings in. So what they should have said was, if you've got urban growth boundaries and you've made housing expensive, you need to get rid of the urban growth boundaries. But that doesn't fit in with the central planner agenda, which is that Americans should live in denser cities. And this mania for density causes them to ignore things like the impact on housing affordability, the impact on the infrastructure, the impact on traffic congestion, and so on and so forth.
Well, and, you know, Karen Levine, who is a RE/MAX Realtor Alliance, one of my partners on the show, has said that the National Board of Realtors had done a study, and people that own a home overall generally create much more wealth for themselves than if they rent throughout their life. And so I feel that this is this kind of a movement that you're talking about, trying to put people into apartments, is subtly an assault on property rights. And Marxism, Randall O'Toole, there's a number of things with it, but the two biggest things are you get rid of the individuality of each person, and then you get rid of property or property rights. And so couched within this AFFH that was put in during the Obama administration, wasn't it, Randall?
Yes. It was.
Okay, I see that as an assault on property rights, the ability for people to own a home, you know, have that opportunity, have that choice to do so. And interestingly, I don't know if you saw this, this was in the Colorado Sun a few weeks ago, and it said that the title was, a Boulder County zip code produced the nation's most greenhouse gas per person, the study shows. I find that fascinating. Boulder is, you know, you think of it as totally environmental, but it's so expensive. And now one zip code is the biggest greenhouse gas contributor. I find that astounding.
That is astounding. And, you know, this is really a property rights issue. It's a property rights issue for the people in rural areas. If you own rural land and you're told, well, you can only farm it, you can't build any houses on your land, which is what they're told. I mean, in Oregon, you're not allowed to build a house in a rural area unless you earn 80 acres of land, you actually farm that land, and you actually earned $80,000 a year farming it in two of the last 3 years. And that really limits how many people can build, because most farmers don't even earn $80,000
right.
a year from their farms in Oregon. So you've taken away those property rights. Now, then when you look at single-family neighborhoods, you get into a question that's heavily debated among libertarians and free market advocates. Is living in a single-family neighborhood a property right? And I argue that it is, because developers have figured out that if there's no zoning, that people will pay more, they'll be more ready, willing to buy a lot or a house if that house has protective covenants on it that says that you can't develop your house and your neighbors can't develop their houses to higher densities than they are right now. And zoning, these protective covenants were actually first developed in the 1850s. And zoning is a way to imitate protective covenants in existing single-family neighborhoods. So pretty much everything that was going to be zoned in a city is already zoned by 1960. So pretty much everybody who's bought a single-family home in a single-family neighborhood bought it knowing that the zoning was there, and they probably were more inclined to buy it because they knew their neighborhood would not be inundated with commercial development or high-density housing development and so on and so forth. So I argue that to say I'm willing to not develop my property on the condition that my neighbors don't develop their properties to higher densities, that's a property right. And single-family zoning is an expression of that property right. You go to a single-family neighborhood and we say, we're going to give you the right to build high-density housing, they're going to say, no, you're taking away our property right. You're taking away our right to live in a single-family neighborhood. That is a property right, and I regard all these attempts to get rid of single-family zoning, which have been successful in Oregon and in Minneapolis, as taking away people's property rights.
That is fascinating. I had not thought about it quite like that. So, Randall O'Toole, another thing is we had talked, one of our conversations during this whole COVID-19 thing we talked about backyards, that actually was people's parks. And during COVID-19, you know, many times people were forbidden to go to the, you know, the park down the street or whatever. And so the fact that people had their own park in their backyard, I think people found that very valuable, Randall O'Toole.
Yes, and you know, people say we shouldn't have urban sprawl because it consumes open space. But you look at where people are building homes in supposedly sprawling areas, it's often farmlands or rangelands. And the thing about farmlands is they have the most environmental impacts of any land use in the world. They take away all the native vegetation and replace it with a monoculture. They spray enormous amounts of pesticides on it. They use enormous amounts of water. And if you convert farmland to suburbs, what you get are much more diverse wildlife habitats, because every homeowner treats their yard differently. And so some yards are attractive to certain birds, other yards are attractive to certain mammals, and so on and so forth. You get a diversity of wildlife habitat. You get a lot less water consumption. You get a lot less application of poisonous chemicals. So converting farms to single-family homes is actually a huge environmental benefit. I remember a biologist did some research to figure out how much biodiversity was reduced when people created suburbs, and they were astounded to find that it actually increased biodiversity.
That is fascinating. The other question, though, is what about the food source? As you take away farmland, we have more people. What about feeding them?
We have 1.1 billion acres of farmland in this country. We only use a third of them for growing crops. And so there's a huge surplus. And guess what? The number of acres we use for growing crops is declining. It's about 350 million acres now, but 40 years ago it was about 420 million acres. And it's not declining because it's being paved over. It's declining because our crop production is increasing. Our yields are increasing faster than our population. We actually can feed all Americans on just 200 million acres. The other 150 million acres are used for exports and for growing corn for ethanol. So we have plenty of land for growing food, and food production is increasing per acre. We don't even need more land. We need less land for growing food.
Absolutely fascinating. Randall O'Toole, many nuggets of information here, so thank you so much. We're out of time. What is the final thought that you would like to leave with our listeners, and how can people get in touch with you and find all of the pieces that you write?
Well, I have a website called The Anti-Planner, and just Google Anti-Planner. I'm the first thing on the list, or go to TI.org. TI stands for Thoreau Institute, TI.org, and look at The Anti-Planner. I publish each week a policy brief, a four-page paper on some issue. Had one on Front Range commuter rail a few months ago, and have had other kinds of issues on transportation and land use. So the Anti-Planner is the way to find me.
Okay, Randall O'Toole, thank you so much, and we'll talk again very soon.
Thank you.
And our quote for today is from Ike Eisenhower. He said, "A people that values its privileges above its principles soon loses both." So my friends, today, be grateful, read great books, think good thoughts, listen to beautiful music, communicate and listen well, live honestly and authentically, strive for high ideals, and like Superman, stand for truth, justice, and the American way. This is Kim Munson signing off. God bless you, and God bless America.
And I don't want no one to cry, but tell them if I don't survive.
The views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker, commentators, hosts, their guests, and callers. They are not necessarily the views and opinions of Crawford Broadcasting or KLZ Management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.
KLZ AM HD Denver, the source AM and FM. AM 560 and 100.7 FM. 560thesource.com.